chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest may have in the middle of it. Rest may have in the middle. We are rest may have.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness, we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a lot going on this week. There's been shootings and deaths have occurred on both sides. Not only in Kenosha, but out in Portland. There was a shooting of a Patriot Prayer follower there, supporter. And then there was a shooting of two men up there in Kenosha. And we've got a man, Kyle Rittenhouse, is in jail right now facing murder charges up there. But anyway, we've got a lot going. We're going to start off with the attorney for Rittenhouse gave an excellent interview on Tucker Carlson. We're going to start off with that now.
A 17-year-old called Kyle Rittenhouse has been charged with two counts of first-degree murder for shootings that took place in Kenosha, Wisconsin recently. There's a lot of confusion about what exactly happened, but in at least two of the shootings, video shows Rittenhouse running away, being attacked, and then firing. What does this add up to? Well, some on the left don't want to know. Antifa, according to accounts online, is trying to figure out what cell Rittenhouse is being held in, presumably so they can kill him. So what's the state of the case? What will Rittenhouse's lawyers argue when it does go to court? To find out, we're speaking tonight to John Pierce. He's representing Kyle Rittenhouse. He's from the firm Pierce Bainbridge, and we're happy to have him on tonight. Mr. Pierce, thanks so much for coming on. So,
hi, Tucker. Thank you so much for having us to get the true story out of what happened in Kenosha.
Well, I'm eager to know, because this is one of those stories that obviously has intense partisan interest, and there's a lot of confusing video. But what is, broadly speaking, the defense that you will mount on behalf of Kyle Rittenhouse?
This is 100% self-defense, Tucker. Kyle, he's a good kid. He's a lifeguard. Kenosha was burning down. Actually, when he got done with work that day, he went to the high school with some friends to try to remove some graffiti. After that, they got a call from a local business person who owns three businesses in downtown Kenosha. Two of those three businesses had been burnt to the ground, and this business owner simply wanted to desperately protect what was left of his life's work, so he asked for help. Kyle and his friends decided that nobody was doing anything to protect that community, and they decided that they would answer that call and help to protect that business. Kyle actually took a first aid kit downtown because he was concerned that there would be wounded protesters downtown. And, in fact, he took a firearm because Kenosha had become a war zone.
Right.
Any sensible person would take that. And him and his friends stayed on the premises and protected that property. Some events started to unfold whereby he was trying to treat medically wounded protesters, and ultimately he got trapped out on the street out in the open because the riot police had moved the line far enough down that they were between himself and that premises.
So I have read that he brought a firearm as a juvenile, 17, across state lines. A lot of people.
That is incorrect.
That's incorrect. Tell us where the gun came from.
That is incorrect. That is incorrect. That firearm never crossed state lines. That is a legal firearm in the state of Wisconsin. Wisconsin is an open carry state. That charge is incorrect as a matter of state law. As a 17-year-old, he was legally entitled to have that firearm in his possession. Moreover, we are going to be arguing that the Second Amendment and Title 10, Section 246 of the United States Code renders that charge and any ordinance that charge would be based on blatantly unconstitutional under these circumstances.
Right. Well, that's really a tertiary charge anyway, because there are other. Let me ask you about the first shooting of Joseph Rosenbaum.
Sure.
The second two, one man was shot in the arm, the other was shot in the midsection and died. Both of them clearly, and that's obvious on video, attacked Rittenhouse. But the first shooting, was Rittenhouse fired upon before he fired? Did he believe he was fired upon? What were the circumstances of that shooting?
Absolutely. There was the New York Times has a report and has analyzed this very closely. There was a shot that was fired as Kyle was retreating, actually, from a mob that had become enraged that he was trying to put out fires that the arsons had set and because he was trying to protect property. The mob became enraged. They began screaming that Kyle needed to be killed and they were going to kill him. They started relentlessly hunting him as prey, as he ran down the street attempting to retreat. As he ran out of room to retreat, a shot was fired from behind him. The New York Times has clearly shown that. Shortly after that, the individual, Mr. Rosenbaum, who was leading the attack on him, set upon him immediately, began to assault him from behind, attempted to take his firearm, and Kyle, when he turned, he instantaneously had no choice but to defend himself by firing because he was in imminent danger of serious bodily harm or death.
So that was the first shooting. So that happened.
That's right.
Called a friend on the phone, said, I think I've killed someone. And then he begins run. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, actually, let me clarify. Let me clarify that. So actually, Kyle actually attempted to stop and to check on the individual who had been shot. He did make a call to his friend. He said to his friend that he had shot someone. He immediately had to retreat from that area because the mob that was the rioters that were chasing him, who had witnessed this, immediately called him out for the shooting, which of course wasn't self-defense, but they called him out for the shooting. They began saying that he needs to be craniumed, that he essentially needed to be killed. So he began retreating back down the street. He began running back down the police line to try to get to safety. Again, the mob relentlessly and viciously pursued him. And he was struck as he was running from behind by one of the rioters. He tripped and fell to the ground. And then one of the rioters was right over him with a Glock. The other one was attempting, and both of them were attempting to disarm him, to take his AR-15. He was successful in being able to fight that off, and he had no choice but to then immediately defend himself. He was in fear of serious bodily harm or death. He fired and disarmed the individual who had the Glock by hitting him in the arm. He shot and killed the other person who was attacking him. And I got to tell you, one thing, if you really think about this, Tucker, in this war zone, in this chaos that was occurring in a city in America in the middle of Wisconsin, Kyle, the only individuals that Kyle shot were the three individuals that were attacking him and putting him at risk of serious bodily harm or death. This is a 17-year-old kid. This is amazing.
So let me ask you this, and I think that's a fair point. He didn't shoot indiscriminately, and in I'm taking your word for it in the first one because I haven't seen the video, but in the second two, I have seen the video. One guy attacked him. The other guy was pointing a gun at him.
Here's
my question. He shot that man in the arm, and the man backed off. That man survived. That man has not been charged. He came at a 17-year-old with a gun. Why has he not been charged?
So here's a question that I have, Tucker. Where are the charges for aggravated assault against Kyle Rittenhouse? Where are the charges for arson in our cities? Where are the charges for rioting? Where are the charges for crossing state lines? And where are the charges against the people who are funding this activity and who are financing it? And why is Kyle Rittenhouse, a 17-year-old lifeguard who is attempting to protect the businesses in his community and attempting to help wounded protesters and was protecting his own life while Kenosha was burning, why is he the one sitting in jail tonight as forces within this country sickeningly attempt to find a way to bring harm to him while he's in detention?
It is sickening. Mr. Pierce, thanks for coming on tonight and giving your side of this, which has not been heard. I haven't heard it anyway, so I appreciate it.
Thank you for letting us tell the truth here, Tucker. I really appreciate it.
This is a statement at a press conference that Kate Brown, governor of Oregon, held recently. And what she's saying about all of this problems in Portland and how they're handling it, this is so idealistically off the wall that I wanted you to listen to this. Here we go now with Kate Brown, governor of Oregon. And this is decidedly, she's on the favor of the protesters, and she's the one promulgating more and more hate and resentment and violence. Here we go now with Kate Brown.
The protests in support of racial equity and police accountability started many weeks ago, 100 days ago. During this period, state elected leaders, working with community leaders from around the state, have attempted to rise to that call. Here's what we've done so far. We passed 6 bills improving police accountability, limiting police use of chokeholds, limiting the use of tear gas by law enforcement for crowd control, and limiting the ability of an arbitrator to overturn police discipline. For those who have experienced racism and discrimination firsthand, I know that slow and steady progress toward justice doesn't feel fast enough. It isn't. Like many of you, I too am angry that black and brown Oregonians continue to fear for their lives and for their families. These accomplishments are just a start, but it's progress in a relatively short period of time. I and other elected leaders need to continue to be held accountable for reducing the economic and health disparities in our state and in our society. There needs to be a community-wide effort to stop the violence, because the violence must stop, period. So we must do both things. We must be tireless in our pursuit of racial justice. We must be tireless in our pursuit of accountability for law enforcement. And we must also work together with responsible law enforcement to end violence and arson in Portland. And this needs to happen immediately.
Coming up next is Dana Perino with, Fox News Network. And there's a little discussion there, panel discussion, about there was a Patriot Prayer follower, Aaron J. Danielson, that was murdered up in Portland. And they discussed, you know, that murder. And then also the suspect that was, you know, being pursued was shot down by federal troops a few days later. But after he had expressed his guilt on a video. So this thing is getting, we just got to try to stop this shooting from both sides. But anyway, this is a real good panel discussion that Fox had. Here we go next.
The man accused of gunning down a pro-Trump supporter in Portland is now dead. Federal officials say agents shot and killed him while trying to make an arrest in Washington state. The suspect had said he is, quote, 100% Antifa, and defended his actions during an interview that aired yesterday.
What I will say is that I felt that my life and other people around me's lives were in danger. And I felt like I had no choice but to do what I did.
That development coming as Portland nears 100 nights of protests, and other big cities are bracing for the possibility of more violence this weekend, including in New York City and certainly others. Jesse, let's go to you first. This is a man who is a father of two, and he had been protesting, you know, all summer. I understand that he felt really committed to his cause, but he was making a choice, and the choice ended in his death.
God rest his soul. I know he leaves behind two children, but my goodness, just do one Google search on this guy. It's. I don't want to speak badly of the dead, but it's not a pretty picture. And to a certain extent, it's not only Wheeler's fault, who's a total failure out there in Portland. This guy was picked up on gun charges just a couple weeks ago. And they dropped the charges. They didn't even prosecute him. He would have been in jail. He wouldn't have been able to do this. To get on Vice while there's a fugitive task force looking to arrest you and try to plead your case shows how arrogant and emboldened Antifa has become. They think they can get away with that stuff. The video evidence and the eyewitness testimony tells a completely different story about that shooting. From everything we know, this was not an act of self-defense. He wasn't saving anyone's life. This looks like cold-blooded murder. He would have gone away for life if he hadn't been shot by deputies. And he was shot because he pulled out a rifle as they approached him. We warned this was going to happen. What did we say about CHOP or CHAZ? You let this thing go, someone's going to die. And they died. We've been saying for 100 days in Portland, someone's going to die, and now they're dead. And it's funny the way the media characterizes this. The media speaks nicely about the shooter and kind of denigrates the guy that was shot dead. They're calling this guy, labeling the dead guy like some right-wing Trump-supporting militia patriot member, and then they whitewash this guy who's about as radical as they come. It's sad they're lying to you, and I think it's really going to backfire.
Greg, what about the fact that a lot of these gun crimes basically don't get prosecuted? They let them go, and then it exacerbates the problem.
Yeah, it's not just this guy. You know, he was busted and let go. This happens a lot in other cities with handguns, especially. If they can't control the handguns in inner cities, how are they going to have a national gun control plan is what I don't understand. I applaud the feds for making the world safer by eliminating an armed murderous hooligan. The variables involved in his life, whether he was a family man or involved in a cause, I don't care. I really don't care. I think the lesson every group needs to learn is that you don't have to glorify a martyr because of their skin color. I am not going to call in sick over this guy because he's white. All right? He murdered a citizen, and Jesse's right. I've already seen certain kinds of language that are being employed to kind of portray him as a martyr because he believed in a cause. I'm sorry. This started when the media deliberately mislabeled violence as protest, justified the actions of miscreants. We knew the violence was happening. We were told by people in the media that we were crazy. Even as the killings spiked, we have now a 50% increase in murder in New York, which we mentioned yesterday. And we are told that we are just sensationalizing this. If people listen to us, there would be two men alive right now, that guy and the Trump supporter.
Geraldo, what are your thoughts?
Well, I don't miss him. I think Jesse's way too compassionate. This was a confessed killer. You live by the gun, you die by the gun. You pull a gun on a federal fugitive task force and you expect to survive. I mean, that shows, you know, they are so living in their own bubble. You didn't want to blame Mayor Wheeler, but they've allowed for 100 days this anarchy, this disorder, this disruption, this violence, this mugging, this usurping of private property, trashing everything, defying the rule of law, killing someone in cold blood at point-blank range. This is where you end up. This should have happened 50 days ago or 100 days ago. This was,
99 days ago.
This Antifa thug is exactly what the president is complaining about. These people flying between cities, bringing their violence with them, conspiring with others to disrupt, taking naive, innocent protesters and bending them to their diabolical purpose. This guy was a terrorist, and he died a terrorist death.
Dagan, let's get a final thought from you.
The feds are on the case. Governor Kate Brown still refusing to call in the National Guard into Portland. The DA, Mike Schmidt of Multnomah County, not prosecuting many of those people arrested. But Attorney General Bill Barr said earlier this week that he talked about radicals crossing state lines and carrying out planned coordinated attacks on law enforcement, public property, and on private property. Guess what? That means, and Andy McCarthy wrote about this, that the the Justice Department is going to be converting, looking at these federal crimes, converting state crimes into federal crimes, crossing state lines, coupled with kind of a loose criminal organization. That's a racketeering enterprise. So you're talking about the feds being in charge now. Yeah. We're talking about long sentences for these crimes to prevent murder potentially. So sanctuary city no more.
These Democrats, whether they're city, you know what I mean, mayors or state governors, have mismanaged not only in Washington State, but Oregon and Kenosha. They brought the, National Guard in pretty quick in Kenosha, and that quieted things down quickly. Minneapolis, that was a basket case. That was totally mismanaged there from the very beginning. But anyway, we've got coming up next is former Ambassador Yovanovitch, that was ambassador to the Ukraine. And here's what a small piece of what she said at the impeachment hearings. And then we're going to let you know what Judicial Watch and Sarah Carter have uncovered since this nice little lady that was our ambassador never did anything wrong. Highly professional is what she states that she was always doing in the Ukraine. Here we go with an ambassador describing herself, herself in a very arrogant, pious way. Here we go now.
As for events during my tenure in Ukraine, I want to reiterate first that the allegation that I disseminated a do not prosecute list was a fabrication. Mr. Lutsenko, the former Ukrainian prosecutor general who made that allegation, has acknowledged that the list never existed. I did not tell Mr. Lutsenko or other Ukrainian officials who they should or should not prosecute. Instead, I advocated the U.S. position that rule of law should prevail, and Ukrainian law enforcement, prosecutors, and judges should stop wielding their power selectively as a political weapon against their adversaries and start dealing with all consistently and according to the law. Also untrue are unsourced allegations that I told unidentified embassy employees or Ukrainian officials that President Trump's orders should be ignored because he was going to be impeached or for any other reason. I did not, and I would not say such a thing. Such statements would be inconsistent with my training as a Foreign Service officer and my role as an ambassador. The Obama administration did not ask me to help the Clinton campaign or harm the Trump campaign, nor would I have taken any such steps if they had. Partisanship of this type is not compatible with the role of a career Foreign Service officer. I have never met Hunter Biden, nor have I had any direct or indirect conversations with him. And although I have met former Vice President Biden several times over the course of our many years in government service, neither he nor the previous administration ever raised the issue of either Burisma or Hunter Biden with me. With respect to Mayor Giuliani, I have had only minimal contact with him, a total of 3, none related to the events at issue. I do not understand Mr. Giuliani's motives for attacking me, nor can I offer an opinion on whether he believed the allegations he spread about me. Clearly, no one at the State Department did. What I can say is that Mr. Giuliani should have known those claims were suspect, coming as they reportedly did from individuals with questionable motives and with reason to believe that their political and financial ambitions would be stymied by our anti-corruption policy in Ukraine. After being asked by the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs in early March 2019 to extend my tour until 2020, the smear campaign against me entered a new public phase in the United States. In the wake of the negative press, State Department officials suggested an earlier departure, and we agreed upon July 2019. I was then abruptly told, just weeks later in late April, to come back to Washington from Ukraine on the next plane. At the time I departed, Ukraine had just concluded game-changing presidential elections. It was a sensitive period with much at stake for the United States and called for all the experience and expertise we could muster. When I returned to the United States, Deputy Secretary of State Sullivan told me there had been a concerted campaign against me, that the President no longer wished me to serve as ambassador to Ukraine, and that, in fact, the President had been pushing for my removal since the prior summer. As Mr. Sullivan recently recounted during his Senate confirmation hearing, neither he nor anyone else ever explained or sought to justify the President's concerns about me, nor did anyone in the Department justify my early departure by suggesting I had done something wrong. I appreciate that Mr. Sullivan publicly affirmed at his hearing that I had served capably and admirably.
Next coming up is Tom Fenton with Judicial Watch. And they've had to sue our own government to force out of our own federal agencies certain emails and things like this that would implicate Ambassador Yovanovitch in some very scurrilous activities while she was ambassador in the Ukraine. So here we go now with Tom Fenton. And that's going to be followed also by Sarah Carter and her investigation into this matter, which has been in the last several years. So here we go with Tom Fenton, Judicial Watch. See what he had to say.
But thankfully, we have the Internet, alternative media that get the word out to you. This is why they hate the Internet. This is why they want to suppress conservatives on the Internet. This is why they want to suppress alternative news sources, even like Fox and One America News and Newsmax and all the independent conservative media publications online, is because we provide an alternative source for the truth, because you're not getting it from the media, which are more or less just liberal advocacy groups. Not even advocacy group is a kind word. They're more like political action committees in many respects. And so, sure enough, Judicial Watch has gotten some astonishing documents that confirmed our initial journalism that there was an enemies list created out of the Ukraine embassy by Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch's team. She was then ambassador to Ukraine. Remember, she was originally appointed by Obama, kept on by President Trump, were reappointed, and Trump finally pulled her back. And it looked like in March of 2019, she had her team had compiled a list of American citizens, all of whom were associated with Trump World somehow, virtually all of whom, to target for illicit monitoring. So we had reported that. Yovanovitch didn't deny that it was taking place during her testimony in the impeachment coup attack on President Trump. She's an anti-Trumper. She's retired. So the documents we asked for documents about this scheme, and it confirmed everything we had reported. There was an enemies list. It was being used to target the Trump team, and it was likely illegal. And they were warned about it. This is the headline. Judicial Watch, State Department records show U.S. Embassy in Ukraine monitored Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, Donald Trump Jr., Rudy Giuliani, journalists, and other U.S. citizens in potential violation of federal law. So we got about 375 pages of documents. I wish I could print them out and show them to you, but I'm obviously not at the office. Showing that the Ukrainian embassy under, again, then Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch, was monitoring the social media accounts, specifically Twitter, it looks like, of these innocent Americans. Now, you wonder, what does the law have to do with that? Why can't they do that? Well, you know, there's nothing in law that prevents a government official from looking at your Twitter account, just looking at it, right? But if they want to start compiling reports about the content of that account and sharing it in an official capacity with others in the government, that's kind of like creating a file on you, right? And that type of activity is severely constricted or restricted by a federal law, among other laws, called the Privacy Act. It protects your privacy. It means the government can't create files on you improperly. That's exactly what was going on in the Ukraine embassy, as they were desperately trying to keep Ambassador Yovanovitch in her job, as they were trying to suppress questions about Ukraine's efforts with Obama to subvert the election in 2016 and subvert questions about what the Soros-connected group was doing there in Ukraine, also involved in the elections, and to suppress questions about, of course, Joe Biden and Burisma and that entire mess. And so what they did was use government employees to track Americans and what they were saying about the topics I just raised. And who are the people they were tracking? Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, Rudy Giuliani. So you had Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer, being improperly tracked by the government. Dan Bongino, you know Dan, Sebastian Gorka, John Solomon, Jack Posobiec, Jack works for OANN, Ryan Saavedra, who's a reporter, I think he's with the Daily Wire, Sarah Carter, who you know from Fox, the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., Michael McFaul, who is actually an Obama appointed, used to be a Russia ambassador, I think. So he's kind of the outlier there, but he is on the list. Lou Dobbs, you all know the great Lou Dobbs, and Pamela Geller, who's a conservative activist out of New York on international issues and anti-Semitism and battling radical Islam. The search terms that were monitored by State Department officials on the social media included Yovanovitch, Ukrainian ambassador, Ukraine Soros. It's interesting how Soros' name keeps on popping up in these scandals. Clinton campaign, and Biden Burisma. And the emails also show that Yovanovitch, was aware of this monitoring. So this is the result of a Judicial Watch lawsuit. We had done the initial reports. We had listed those names previously. We have the documents that show that list was exactly right. And that the search terms were even more political than we thought. You know, when we first reported it, we had a source tell us, this is not an obscure rule. I mean, the Privacy Act and that law and the other laws like that. Everyone in public diplomacy or public affairs know they can't make lists and monitor U.S. citizens unless there is a major national security reason. If the illicit operation occurred, it seems to indicate a clear political bias against the president and his supporters. Yovanovitch, as we reported, a career diplomat who also led American embassies in Kyrgyzstan and Armenia, was appointed ambassador to Ukraine by Obama in 2016, so she was there during the election season. She was recalled by the State Department in May of last year, and now she's no longer a State Department official. This is what the email says. Monitoring, developing U.S. social media narratives on Ukraine. Hi, thanks very much for your notes. The English language Twitter search phrases we're currently using for the issues are, as I said, Yovanovitch, common misspelling, so two spellings of the name, Ukraine ambassador, Ukrainian ambassador, Ukraine Soros. We're also monitoring the tweets of roughly 10 high-profile U.S.-based social media users, verified accounts with large numbers and followers, who have already commented on this particular issue before, either on social media or on television. See if they have posted something new relevant to this issue that does not directly align with our search terms. So not only were they using the search terms to search, but they were carefully monitoring them directly. And so what they needed was help in the state. So the Ukrainian embassy is doing this, and they wanted the State Department in Washington, D.C. to provide support because they couldn't do it 24/7, so they thought the State Department in Washington, D.C. should do it. And the State Department said, hold on a second. Let me read you what he wrote in response. The official whose name is redacted. Going to chime in here. So regarding the influencers, there are some legal implications of making a list of Facebook influencers, of Twitter influencers, since they are technically private citizens, even though they're publicly on the internet. And we cannot compile them into a list, and monitor what they're saying using a third-party application without their knowledge. To see what they're saying, you unfortunately need to use the old school way and manually go to their feeds and view that way. Cumbersome, but it's in compliance with the Privacy Act of 1974. And what they've been doing was using this CrowdTangle program, which then was available to them, that helped them monitor social media. It was created by, I think it was bought out by Facebook, and Facebook eventually stopped letting the government use it for purposes like this. And you know who else was involved? It was this Ambassador Kent, who seemed to be very much concerned about what was going on. And you may recall him as being one of the witnesses in the coup attack on President Trump. And this is what Kent wrote about it. Excuse me, but I have to use my phone to look all this up. Kent writes, key thing is to get up to ramming speed from the get-go. And he made it clear, Kent, that he wanted this for political purposes. It wasn't because they were looking at what people were saying generally about it. He wanted to know who was attacking them. And, you know, I told you last week about another set of documents we had uncovered from the Strzok Page emails, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, showing that Strzok and the Comey FBI started investigating Trump's tweets after he criticized Obama for spying on him. And, of course, the FBI indirectly. So you got the President of the United States being illicitly targeted by the FBI for sending out First Amendment-protected tweets. And here you have his family, his lawyer, and journalists and conservative activists also being improperly targeted, all around the same time, by the way, March through May of 2017. I mean, you think Spygate is just about Trump? It ain't about just Trump. It's about all Americans.
This thing that they weaponized was, they weaponized the federal government. The Democrats did under, you know, whoever, you know, was doing it. Some would say, alleged that Hillary was involved, Obama, everybody, you know, that was coming out of the last administration got together. And they weaponized the government and kept this Spygate thing going. Now, Sarah Carter has been on this thing for several years. And here's what she had to say recently about the evidence that just came out that Judicial Watch had uncovered. Here we go now with Sarah Carter, number one lady. Here we go now.
Not only were you looking at my Twitter account at Sarah Carter DC, but guess who else was watching Sarah Carter DC's Twitter account along with Sean Hannity's, Sebastian Gorka's, John Solomon, Dan Bongino, Laura Ingraham, among others, Jack Prosviak, and Pamela Geller. Guess who? Oh, wait, Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump Jr. It was the former Ukrainian, well, American ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. Remember, she was the one that testified against President Trump. Well, guess what? She was using U.S. dollars, U.S. taxpayer dollars, to monitor our social media accounts. I wrote about this in October 2019. I talked to sources. I confirmed that Judicial Watch was looking for these documents from the State Department, that they had filed a Freedom of Information Act request from the United States State Department to see if what we were being told by sources was true. These sources approached Judicial Watch. They reported on the actions of Marie Yovanovitch, which they should. I mean, what's happening here, folks? When in the world does a U.S. ambassador, a U.S. embassy in Ukraine, decide to monitor American citizens and their social media accounts, basically spy on us? You know what I want to know? I want to know how far the FBI went, because I was told that not only was I being monitored by the FBI, but that Sean Hannity was being monitored by members of the FBI, former Obama officials with the FBI, were also monitoring us, because they just couldn't figure out early on, how did we know so much? Who were our sources? Who were our sources? Monitoring. I mean, John Solomon and I both heard the same thing. And we were talking to people. And there were times when I actually went to members of Congress. I had to go meet with them in person, which I do normally. But, you know, if you have a normal telephone call, if you're asking a simple question, you know, Q&A, I need an answer to this. Can I get a comment? There were some congressional members at the time. This is going back to 2017, 2018, 2019, that would not talk on the phone with me because they were absolutely certain that my phone was being monitored. I mean, this is out of control. This is not the former Soviet Union. At least I didn't think so, right? We're the United States of America. We have a constitution. We have a Fourth Amendment. A Fourth Amendment that guarantees us that right to privacy. Unreasonable search and seizure. You're not allowed to monitor me. And let alone, you're not allowed to use taxpayer dollars to do so. This is just ridiculous. Like, what was she doing? Ambassador Yovanovitch. Collecting information on who I was talking to or what? I mean, what? What I was tweeting? I mean, did she really need to spend taxpayer dollars to do this? To monitor all of us? I tell you this right now. If we don't hold people accountable for these egregious violations, then we have ourselves to blame. This is why the Department of Justice, I'm so tired of how slow and how long they are taking to get everything done, especially when it comes to the Russia hoax, right? What they did to an American president, a duly elected president of these United States, people, this is not some science fiction novel. This is what happened to you and me, the American people. For those of you that voted for Donald Trump, this is an affront to you. This isn't about President Trump. And I've said this over and over again. They hated him. They didn't want him there. They didn't want him there because they knew he was going to do what you asked him to do. You know what they don't like? And I'm talking about the far radical left and all these crazy Lincoln Project, right, pretend to be right-wing conservatives. They're not. They're not. They pocket money. They run this town like a swamp. They're a bunch of lobbyists. They party with some of the worst people. They maneuver in circles that exclude you. You think they go to Walmart? They think you're deplorable if you go to Walmart just as much as they thought that way as Hillary Clinton thought about the American voter who voted for President Trump. They don't care about you. They don't care about you. They're the one percenters, right? Look at Mitt Romney. Look at some of these guys. They don't care. They play games. And you know the sad thing is that the left is also buying into some of this. When I see kids out in the streets, when I see them rioting and protesting and, you know, doing this and that and reacting to all of this craziness that's happening in our world, we're not even thinking. We're not even waiting for evidence, even in the police shootings or the deaths of people, which, I mean, is horrible and horrific. What happened to George Floyd was absolutely horrible. Terrifying. It's terrifying to watch. It's horrible. No human being should have to go through that. But we should have all the facts, calm, reasonable people would do that. But they're using the media and their allies in the media to stir up hate. And it's coming, and it's coming to Washington, D.C. on September 17th. On September 17th, this Occupy Wall Street junk that's happening. They're pushing it and pushing it. I don't know who they are. These are the Occupy Wall Street. These are the leftist radicals, the BLM folks that are part of that organization. Not that Black lives don't matter. Black lives do matter. It matters. Every life matters. And Black lives do matter. And George Floyd's life matters. And other lives, all people who lose their life in such a tragic way, period, matter. But I'm talking about the organization. And I'm talking about Antifa and these groups. And they're planning a sit-in 50 days through the election. You don't think these young people are being manipulated by forces far greater than they are? They are. All of these young people are. Just go to the social media accounts. See who funds this, see who's backing this, who's giving money to BLM, who's giving money to offshoot groups. Just look. Famous movie stars, big, you know, foundations that are very left and radical. And I wouldn't even doubt it if some money's being funneled from other countries into these groups. And I'm talking about Cuba. What about Cuba? What about China? What about Russia? Who knows? I don't know. We need to investigate that. But what we need to know is that we are being played. The American people are being played. We are being pitted against one another, and we should not be. I talked about it on our last podcast. The coolest thing about this country, the greatest thing about our nation is freedom. Is freedom. And I can't tell you how angry I was once again to see these documents that verify, these are emails, internal emails inside the State Department, that all of our social media was being monitored. Look, I don't even care. I put it out there. It's social media. I want people to see it. But to waste your taxpayer dollars to basically target me, to target Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, Rudy Giuliani, Donald Trump Jr., John Solomon, blah, 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 Dan Bongino, who's a friend of mine, to target us because we're conservatives, or to target people because they're friends with President Donald Trump, makes me wonder. I'm just asking you this question. It makes me wonder how far they have gone, right? Because it didn't end there. It didn't end with just monitoring our social media accounts. I can guarantee you that.
This is a danger to our whole country, to our liberty and freedoms. Coming next is an interview that Tucker had with a man that actually exposed the critical race theory. And by God, you know what happened? He called for President Trump to declare it not to be taught in our federal agencies. And President Trump did it today. It was just announced. But here's the interview that precipitated President Trump in halting the teaching of critical race theory in our federal bureaucracies. Here we go now.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. If you've watched this show over the past few months, you know that we have fixated, sometimes the exclusion of other important things, on the riots and disorder that have paralyzed many American cities. We haven't done this for partisan reasons. Honestly, it is a presidential year, but the threat that we're facing is deeper and more significant than any single election. Political violence is the greatest threat we face. It is more dangerous than any virus or any foreign adversary. It could literally end this country. We've told you who's responsible for the violence. We didn't need to tell you. You knew it. It's obvious, no matter what the professional liars are now claiming on television. The main suspect, for example, in the most recent political assassination in Portland has a BLM logo tattooed on his neck. He's not hiding what team he's on. None of them are. Every honest person watching understands exactly what is going on in our streets. What too few understand, though, is why it's happening. Why would kids raised in the fairest country in the world support a violent revolutionary group like BLM, whose program consists mainly of destroying things? Why would educated adults, the very people who should be defending our system, whom we need to defend our system, be working so hard to tear it down? Historians will inevitably study these questions. They're going to want to know what happened here. They'll conclude that ideology played a major role in all of this. For a generation, Americans have been taught to accept the underlying premises that made BLM possible. Human beings can be reduced to their race. Skin color equals privilege. Equality under the law must be abandoned. These are lies, but suddenly they're everywhere. Americans have learned them in school, learned them on the job, heard them even in church. Without these ideas, we wouldn't have riots right now. We wouldn't put up with them for a second. So where is this poison coming from? Well, ultimately, it comes from the academic left, which controls this country's intellectual life, such as it is. But the product they're selling has been disseminated widely by the media, by corporate HR departments, even by the federal government, which you pay for, all of us do. The problem is larger than most people understand. Larger, in fact, than we understood until we read the reporting of a man called Chris Rufo. Rufo has spent months investigating critical race theory indoctrination, the mandatory Maoist struggle sessions that are now underway in your office and in your kid's school. Highly paid diversity trainers systematically attack the unifying ideals of this country. They pit Americans against each other based on the color of their skin. It is a grotesque project. It is wrong. It is openly racist. Over time, it leads to violence and permanent division. We're seeing it now. It is terrifying. But virtually no one challenges it. We should challenge it for the sake of our country. So tonight we've asked Chris Ruffo to walk us through some of what is happening here. You should know the details. Ruffo is a research fellow at the Discovery Institute as well as a contributing editor at City Journal, and he joins us now. Chris Ruffo, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much. You know, Tucker, this is something I've been investigating for the last 6 months, and it's absolutely astonishing how critical race theory has pervaded every institution in the federal government. And what I've discovered is that critical race theory has become, in essence, the default ideology of the federal bureaucracy and is now being weaponized against the American people. I'd like to share three investigations that I've unleashed that show the kind of depth of this critical race theory, occult indoctrination, and the danger and destruction it can wreak. First, the Treasury Department. I broke the story on the Treasury Department, which held a seminar earlier this year from a man named Howard Ross, a diversity trainer who has billed the federal government more than $5 million over the past 15 years, conducting seminars on critical race theory. And he told Treasury employees essentially that America was a fundamentally white supremacist country, and I quote, virtually all white people uphold the system of racism and white superiority, and was essentially denouncing the country and asking white employees at the Treasury Department and affiliated organizations to accept their white privilege, accept their white racial superiority, and accept essentially all of the baggage that comes with this reducible essence of whiteness. Second, this is not by any means limited to the Treasury Department. Critical race theory has actually now infiltrated our criminal justice system. Just this week, I released a story that the FBI is now holding weekly seminars on intersectionality, which is a hard left academic theory that reduces people to a network of racial, gender, and sexual orientation identities that intersect in complex ways and determine whether you are an oppressor or oppressed. Obviously, with the white straight male, such as FBI Director Christopher Wray, being at the top of this pyramid of evil. And third, this is a major story. Critical race theory is now infiltrating into our scientific establishment. A few weeks ago, I released a story that critical race theorists at the Sandia National Laboratories, which creates our nuclear weapons arsenal, sent their white male executives on a three-day re-education camp to deconstruct their white male culture and actually force them to write letters of apology to women and people of color. Whistleblowers within Sandia National Laboratories have now spoken out, but laboratory executives have dispatched counterintelligence teams to quickly erase their communications, silence, and shut them down. And this is really the bottom line. There are some great people in D.C., such as Senator Josh Hawley in Missouri, that are starting to push back. But conservatives need to wake up that this is an existential threat to the United States, and the bureaucracy, even under the Trump administration, is now being weaponized against core traditional American values. And I'd like to make it explicit. The president of the White House, it's within their authority and power to immediately issue an executive order abolishing critical race theory trainings from the federal government. And I call on the president to immediately issue this executive order and stamp out this destructive, divisive, pseudoscientific ideology at its root. And I think that it's something that he's denounced, this kind of Black Lives Matter and neo-Marxist rhetoric in places like Portland and Seattle. But it's time to take action and destroy it within his own administration.
The consequences of what you described are profound. I think we're seeing some of them now on our streets. But I want to get to the second example because it may be the most troubling of all, the Department of Justice. So the underlying idea behind our entire justice system is that all of us are treated equally under the laws of the United States. Your race, your gender, who you sleep with are irrelevant in the eyes of the law. How could the FBI, which is armed and empowered to uphold those laws, be disseminating lies like this, which are exactly contrary to their mission? I mean, how corrosive is that? How scary is that?
It's extremely corrosive, and what we're seeing is that the institutions of the federal government, the actual bureaucracies and agencies and this kind of permanent administrative state, has really abandoned the core American principles of equality under the law, of judging individuals as individuals on their merits, and they're now adapting this radical left ideology of judging people from their group identity, and it's absolutely terrifying that the FBI, which has almost kind of plenary physical authority in the United States, would be adapting this ideology, and I think it's a red alert moment, and all Americans should be deeply worried about their country.
They should be. This has nothing to do with this election. It has to do with our future as a nation. Very quickly, there are reports that this is going on in the United States military. Is that true?
Yeah, I've had some leaks from inside the U.S. military, in the Air Force and the Navy. I'm still working on these stories to source them, to confirm them. But what I can say is this, is that they are essentially, starting in 2011 with an Obama executive order, mandating diversity and inclusion initiatives throughout the federal government. They've created these offices of diversity and inclusion who ostensibly are supporting greater diversity. But in practice, according to sources throughout the federal government, serve as almost internal intelligence services to perpetuate this ideology and to root out conservative ideas and ultimately purge conservative employees.
A diverse country can't handle this for long. We need to be unified by our equality under the law, or we won't be unified. And by the way, if there are people watching us who've experienced it, I hope you'll reach out to us whistleblowers within the military or other federal agencies. We'll reach out to Chris Ruffo or to us, because we're going to keep on this story. Chris Ruffo, thanks so much for your report tonight. I appreciate it.
And go off the air with a short clip here. Okay, it's really important. Listen to this.
Jesus himself is on Joe Biden's side. Remember when they used to attack Jerry Falwell for saying stuff like that? And Falwell, if he ever said it, shouldn't have said it, because it's wrong to pretend God is on the side of a political party. They're not ashamed to do it themselves, that's for sure. Eric Metaxas is a best-selling author, thought a lot about these questions. He's written a new book, Donald and the Fake News. Eric Metaxas joins us. And Eric, thanks so much for coming on. The video of the Catholic Mass in which the Nicene Creed has been replaced by talking points from BLM really should make us think.
Well, it's stroking violence, if I can coin a phrase. I'll be honest with you, if they had a swastika on the altar, it would be no different. Churches have always, Christians have always been at the forefront of fighting racism and slavery. There is no question about that. We need to understand that the civil Yes. rights movement in this country and the abolition movement in Europe and in this country was led by Christians. What we're seeing here is something else entirely. The people who are using these new terms, systemic racism or white privilege, these are Marxists. These people not only don't believe in God, they hate God, and on the website, the BLM website, they reject just about everything a Christian would say. So what they are doing now, it's a power play. They want to hollow out the church from the inside, because the real church is their enemy. This kind of a church that will do this kind of nonsense, of course, is perfect for them. But we saw this, unfortunately. I wrote a book about Bonhoeffer being a Christian in the 30s, seeing the Nazis do this. In other words, they didn't come and say, hey, we want you to worship the devil, hey, we're atheists, hey, we don't believe in God. They would come in and they would effectively co-opt the churches, but force the churches to play along just enough so that slowly they could confuse people and take over. And what we're seeing right now is exactly that. When you're using these kinds of terms, I want to say to every pastor, every Christian in America, this is something, if you do not reject this with everything you have, you are bringing about the death of Christian faith in America, which, by the way, is the only hope for people who think racism is wrong. It is only the Bible that says we're made in God's image. Ask
right.
Marxists if they believe in God's image. Ask, what did Karl Marx say about races? He was a vicious racist, Karl Marx. So Marxists are just doing this to get power. They have no values. They couldn't care less about whether we're made in God's image. They don't believe in it. But they are using pastors like this and churches like this. And listen, there are many good Christians and good pastors who are going along with this, thinking they're doing a good thing. I want to say to them, you're riding on the back of a tiger. That tiger will eat you. That tiger hates you is using you right now. This is a warning to every American. That is what's going on. I write about it in my Bonhoeffer book, and I've talked about it, but it is absolutely chilling. That video and what I read in the article, absolutely chilling. They are taking over churches. Don't let it happen to your church.
Our only hope is the knowledge that God created us all equal. All equal. We all have equal value, period. All lives matter. That's the Christian message. Eric Panaxis, thank you.